Hello, folks. Welcome to season four, first episode of the Snowy's Camping Show. Joined as usual by myself, Ben and Lauren. How are you for the start of the new year?
Good.
Well, it's a bit later than the start of the new year, but start of the new year for this show. Yeah. So season one, 2024, we were just having a laugh, realizing that this is actually season four, and we've been doing this for four years.
Yeah.
Which it doesn't feel like that long.
No, it doesn't.
We've been through three studios and 4 years. Anyway, if you haven't already done so, you may be new to the show. You can subscribe via YouTube. You can also listen in on your favorite podcast app. And you can join in on the conversation at the Snowy's Camping Banter Facebook group, where myself and Lauren are in there answering questions where we can, but there's a lot of people in there with a lot of knowledge now. And usually by the time we get to reading questions and answers, everyone else has already answered it for us. So it's a really cool community full of people with lots of camping, hiking, caravan, car camping, all sorts of knowledge.
Awesome group of people.
So we're kicking off this year with, you put a post in the Facebook group we just talked about, saying we might do a Q&A session to kick off.
Yeah, I know, if you have listened before season three wrap up, we were like, man, we haven't done a Q&A session for ages.
Yeah. So you put a question out there and we got over 100 comments.
Yeah, it's like 108 as of this morning. Yeah, and I was just a bit like, you.
So we've got four pages of questions here, and we went, we might have to do a few episodes
to work it out.
So there's three sessions worth of questions here. Mm. And you know what? If we talk too much, so we might even have to break each session up into a part A and B, but we'll see how we go.
Yeah.
Session one, starting off with session one. It's a good place to start. Session one,
good place to start.
Have you got anything to add for 2024? What are you planning on? Do you do New Year's resolution? You don't seem like a New Year's resolution person to me.
No, not really. I was just thinking about, do I have something profound to say in this moment? I don't.
No, okay.
Don't do New Year's resolutions, except for would really like to put a bit more effort in or make more of a conscious effort to get away more this year, because I know, as everybody who listens to us regularly would know, Ben and I did not really get away much last year at all in terms of what we would at least be happy about for ourselves. So, of course, prioritizing that this year is really important. But in terms of New Year's resolutions, no.
Not really.
Just keep on keeping on.
Yeah. Much the same. I don't know if I'm going to get away much more this year, because looking ahead with all my kids' activities and the extra stuff they're taking on, the windows of opportunity are dwindling away.
Yeah, I think potentially that's a really important point if you do have if you are a family and you do have kids, especially sort of in that early teen phase.
This is where I'm at.
They're just starting to want to experience everything that they can in their life. And of course, as parents, you want to facilitate as much of that as you can. Mm. And of course, then that means summer sports, winter sports, more than one kid. You might have summer sport on a Saturday and then, sports Saturday, Sunday. Like for me in winter, it's literally Friday night, Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon, Sunday morning, between all of the kids. And so it's quite hard to sort of, nip away.
Yep. Each of my kids have at least 5 nights a week across weekdays and weekends of sport going on, and then carnivals and trips away. So we try and tie in a trip away with going away for a carnival or an event or something.
Yeah.
So.
But it's temporary, right? Like it's, a couple of years of your life max, and then you go for it.
Well, my wife and I look at the dollars and time. And firstly, I think, what did I do with my time before I had kids? I should be far better qualified than just about everything than I am now. And secondly, by the time they're paying their own way and we're not running them about, we're going to have a lot more time and a lot more money in the bank.
I think about that all the time. Right, let's get stuck into the episode. So kicking off, I probably might preface this that if you're listening and you've asked a question, there are some questions that we've decided to skip in our Q&A sessions, but we will dedicate a whole episode to that because we thought it would be a good topic. And maybe if you've answered more than one question, we might have sort of taken those questions across a couple of episodes just to sort of even it out a bit. So First things first, Craig on YouTube has said that induction cooking is on trend. Can you discuss what is available for induction cooking for camping? And then he's listened to our first podcast from day one and every podcast since.
Good
so
to know.
Thanks, Craig.
You're still here, Craig. That's awesome. Four seasons later.
Yeah, on to your fourth year. That's awesome.
So you're big on induction, aren't you? And we got these induction cookers in,
yeah.
Kind of thinking, oh, you can use them for camping, but you did a video, you'll elaborate.
I mean, I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily big on induction. I just personally find that they work or induction works for me and my mm-hmm. family, in the sense that if you want to camp year round, you know, you don't necessarily want to be carrying gas and all of that sort of stuff. And then fire ban season, total fire ban days, blah, 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 blah. Induction sometimes is just a bit easier. But then of course you have the offside of that you need to somehow power your induction. And as far as I'm aware, I could be wrong. Induction is 240 volts, so you require an mm-hmm. inverter and all that sort of jazz. But in terms of what is available for induction cooking for camping, whilst there are a couple of models out there that might make a camping specific induction, realistically, from what I understand, the only things that are making that camping specific is perhaps a lower wattage or a scalable wattage between burners mm-hmm. or something like that. But realistically, when it comes to induction cooking for camping, if it's a portable induction cooker, you can take it camping. There's yep. realistically no difference at all.
Yep.
And so the things that you might want to consider are the size and the weight, depending on what your pack size is and exactly what that wattage is. Mm-hmm. And not just the wattage, but also the efficiencies, because obviously, as I mentioned before, you're going to need to power that, which means you're going to need to have an inverter and you're going to need to have a battery system. And preferably, well, not preferably, but you will also need to have solar or something that is going to be recharging your battery system. So before, when I mentioned scalable ones, and I'm probably going to get this brand name wrong, which is totally fine because I don't care about mispronouncing things, but I think it's Safari or something like that. That's okay. The name of it. And it's like a double cooker induction, which has a maximum wattage, which I don't know. So I'm not even going to pretend to know, but hypothetically say it's 2,500 watts, right? And one burner might be 1,000 and one burner might be 1,500. But if you're only using one burner, it scales the wattage so that you could use the total on the one burner, but then if you're using two, it divides it. Does that make sense? Whereas some other ones don't have that option. It's just here's your maximum wattage. Yeah. And then some will also have a boost capacity as well, which is just extra wattage for a shorter period of time for if you're wanting to boil water and things like that. But I think for the most part, unless you have a very large battery system and a very good quality inverter and a decent solar setup, you're probably going to want to be just sticking with induction for powered camping sites mm-hmm. because they do draw quite a lot. So I would say on average, roughly, it would take you, or it would take about 10 amp hours to boil 1 liter of water.
Yep. Okay. And you're talking a 100 amp hour battery in a car, 50 usable amp hours, you're only boiling 5 liters of water.
Correct. And so, you know, if you're using an AGM battery or something, mm-hmm. so maybe 6 liters of water, 7 at the most, if you've got a lithium.
Yep.
And so, obviously that's boiling water. So if you're going to be just sauteing stuff or cooking, you're obviously going to be drawing less power. But when you say, you know, compare that to other 12 volt appliances that you might have, like a fridge and lights and whatever, the load on your system is a lot higher with an induction cooker. So just be really mindful, I think, before you invest in the actual induction cooker, of making sure that you know what style of cooking you're going to be doing and what you want to be using your induction cooker for, roughly how many amps you're going to want to be consuming, and then making sure that you've got a battery and solar system that will set up for that. The other thing to consider is with your inverter, that because now I'm going to muddle my way through this, and again, it's cool. Please, someone jump into the comments to explain it in a more
legible manner,
professional way. But let's just say this is my for dummies explanation. is that because the induction cooker is using like a magnetic vibration to heat your food, that you can have some vibration run back down through the negative to your inverter. So some inverters, I know it's like called chatter or something like that. It's basically just chatter between the wires within your wiring sheath, is that some inverters are better designed, or higher quality inverters are better designed to cope with that returning chatter than others. And if you have an inverter that's not going to cope with that returning chatter very well, then the efficiency of the inverter is going to be affected.
Okay.
So just little things to consider.
Maybe to summarize that, if you want to use induction, try and use 240. Otherwise, it's going to be an expensive setup really to use it properly on 12 volt.
And I think once you've got it set up, you're fine. But I think like we've got a, we've got 400 amp hours of battery in our van, and we've got a 3,500 watt Victron inverter, and things like that, because obviously my partner being an electrician sort of has more, access to really good quality gear. So in that sense, we don't have a lot of issue. And yes, the initial outlay is expensive, but we've got that for a long time and there are a lot of benefits to that, but it can be expensive.
You probably set it up to run other things as well. If you're just doing it for your stove, it's an expensive setup. If you're running other 240 volt appliances, then probably worth it.
We're not, but, we're talking about potentially at some stage wanting to take a couple of months off and, that's going to be our only power source. So just things like that.
And don't have to take
if it's just a weekend thing, potentially not worth it, Anyway.
Moving on. That was a long-winded answer there, Craig. I hope that.
And we might do something a bit deeper into inductions at some stage in the future.
I think we'll see it evolve a bit, induction. Yeah. I'm sure it's on the radar of many manufacturers and there's a lot of research going on that we don't know about. So watch this space. So Mark Smith on Facebook, excuse me, you all coming back to Milmerran this year for the Camp Oven Festival. If so, look forward to catching up with you all. So for those of you who don't know the ACOF, we call it, Australian Camp Oven Festival, it's on every 2 years. So 2 years ago, a crew of us flew up there and met with our Brendale team who are up there at the festival, and we had a shop and
Milmerran, Queensland.
Milmerran, Queensland, and Cam, who works here in our Adelaide store, entered the cooking competition and it was pretty cool. Festival, we got totally rained out and we were sleeping in water.
it was actually very fun.
It was good fun.
Yeah.
So we are looking at doing that again this year. We're speaking to him at the moment.
Planning stages.
It's just in the planning and stages about working out how that looks, I suppose. So we will be sure to update everyone as we lock things in there.
Well, the answer is yes though, right? Like we will be there. In some capacity. We don't know what we're doing or how we're doing it, but we will be there.
Yep. Watch this space.
Also check out, we did a little short film on Cam's cooking competition thing, which is on our YouTube channel. If you want to watch that, cause I think it's a bit of a fun video.
Yeah. We haven't done any episodes with Cam for a while. So
do you remember that little mini doco in the lead up for him. Just for him with the cooking show?
Yeah, that was cool. We'd like to do more cooking episodes with Cam too, but that's all in discussions at the moment.
Yes. Curtis from Facebook, he has asked a couple of questions. So his first question for this episode is, I'm planning a trip to Cape York this year. Well done. Congratulations. Jealous. Unfortunately, being the only four-wheel driver without family commitments in my social circle, I am going solo. How would you go about finding others in a similar boat to potentially tag along with? Or just go solo and see who you meet along the way. I'm going to say I personally think going solo is awesome.
Yeah.
We do actually have a blog post, Curtis, called Solo Four Drive Trip or like going on a solo four drive trip. So there might be some good information in there if you read it through. But I just think that I mean, that sort of sounds like a dream to me. Like I love my family and I love friends and whatever, but the idea of just being able to go on a bit of an extended solo trip sounds really great. You're not sort of limited by other people's expectations or what other people want to do. You can go at your own pace. If you want to take a little side trip because something tickles your fancy, then you can, such a huge opportunity for sort of downtime and things like that. I would say, you can obviously chime in after me, but I would say there's a couple of things that I would make sure about. And the first one is make sure you sort of have a rough idea of your route and your or route or whatever people call it.
Yes.
Yeah, a rough like route prep and a vehicle prep. So then people who you are leaving behind who care about you if you go missing have a bit of an idea about where you're going to be, and you know that for the most part your vehicle's going to be covered. I would also get a bit of education around solo recovery for your four-wheel drive, because if you're doing it by yourself, there's going to be some maybe some different pieces of kit or different skills that you're going to need to be able to pull yourself out of situations. And the third thing would be just to make sure that you've got a method of communication that's going to be reliable for that whole trip.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think safety is a big one going solo, so that people, as you say, loosely know where you are, something you can check in with now and then, so that if something does happen or something goes out of the ordinary, they can send for help, and an emergency way of contact, whether PLB is my favourite in that respect.
Yeah.
But you can also use like the Spot or the Zoleo, which allows you just to send a text message to check in. In terms of solo recovery, I think that's a good skill to have, but I do also think you probably want to give yourself a bit of time with a remote trip like that to maybe just, if you get to a point and you think, I'm not sure, I'm not confident, maybe just sit and wait for another party to come along.
That's true.
And do it with them. Mm-hmm. And in saying that, you also need to be comfortable with a bit of, you know, approaching people you don't know, which on this type of trip, most people are going to be willing to help out or just have a chat 100%. Anyway. So just be comfortable with approaching people and saying, hey, can I tag along on this section? Or make sure you ask questions. Who are people coming the other way? What can I expect ahead? Is there anything I should wait for? So be prepared just to bunker down for a night or two. You might have to wait for people to come along.
Yeah.
So don't be too tight with your timeframes that you're thinking, oh, I've got to do this by myself because I need to be back by this
date. That's a really good point.
Could put you in a dangerous situation.
And I think a trip like that is relatively remote and hardcore, but it's also very popular. So even if you do have to wait, you won't be waiting for long. And I can almost guarantee that you will rock up to a campsite or somewhere to stay and there'll be other people there and they'll, you know, you'll be at it. They'll invite you for a beer or you can have a chat about stuff and get information about the track ahead if they come. You know what I mean? Like it's not, you're going on your own, but it's not like you won't see anybody for the whole trip.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, if you've got firstly water and shelter and some food, enough to cover you for a good number of days. If you have to sit for a week by yourself, I could think of worse places than to have to be camped by myself in a week, just sitting in the bush waiting for someone to come along.
Yeah.
So if that happens, don't panic. Just enjoy being by yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
Next question. Mark Farita, hopefully I've said that right, on Facebook, what's the most compact four-season tent for a family of four? Now, four-season is a bit of a loose – for those who are looking for specific tent categories, there's no line in the sand where a tent crosses over from three to four. You can use the three-season tent in four-season conditions and back the other way. So by four-season tent, I guess if we boil it down to just some simplistic like things, it's a full nylon inner, not a mesh inner, and a fly that is – it doesn't have too many windows and sort of stuff in it.
Are you talking in terms of like more hiking / expedition style four season tents, or are you talking family tents?
Well, that's a blurry thing too, because my immediate thought, four season tent.
When someone says I want four season tent, I'm thinking maybe they're doing Vic High Country in winter and there'll be a bit of snow around. Or they're expecting to camp all through winter and deal with pretty hectic rains and wind.
Yep. And in which case those tents are made with extra stable poles, things to withstand snow loading, and probably have features that are over what is required for a family four-season tent, which I'm assuming you're going to the point of saying you're camping in cold, wintry weather conditions.
And I personally am not sure. I mean, when you mentioned before about seasons ratings on tents and season threes and fours and sort of can be a bit interchangeable, I have personally experienced some manufacturers slash camping brands that advertise their tent as like a four season tent. And it's like, bro, this is like a 2 to 3 at most. Yep. So there's no real hard and fast rule about a season rating. It's more just knowing what to look for in whether or not that tent is going to meet your needs. Mm-hmm. And I would say for majority of situations in Australia where somebody would camp, a three season tent would more than
absolutely
happily cover you.
Yep.
But having said that, in terms of sort of season 4/ expedition style tents, it's not really that a family rated, right?
Season dome tent can be a family tent, right? So what correct. Comes to mind is the Black Wolf classic domes. There's yep. a four person. That's
Would they, like hypothetically, I'm not sure if I would be happy in a four season in a Black Wolf dome tent in snow.
This probably not in snow. I'm sort of making that assumption that yeah. we're just talking wet, wintry conditions. Yeah. Snow's a harder one. You're going to have trouble finding, like, you probably need to look at like a Zempire or like an air tent style scenario for snow. But even then, it's not good for heavy snow.
If you think about like canvas tents, for example, like your RVs and your turbos yep. and things like that, I would potentially say that they're four season tents because yep. for the most part, anywhere in Australia, at least even Vic High Country, you're going to be sorted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So like in terms of so what I've sort of put down here is I reckon something like the Black Wolf Turbo 3.
300, yep.
In the sense that he wants something that's going to be compact. So that's going to pack up a bit more compact than your RV tents because mm-hmm. obviously they're long and need to go on your roof.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to have a bit more structure. I mean, you could even go the Darchi Safaris potentially because yep. of how narrow they are. But in terms of having a family of four and wall space and potentially wanting to put stretchers in or whatever it is that you're going to do, obviously with those tapered walls, you're losing headspace as you go up. Mm-hmm. So you could potentially go for something like the 350, which is compact in the sense that it is flat, but it packs into like a meter square almost. Like yep. we've just recently done a video on that, so you can check that out. But something like the Turbo 300 gives you like a 3 meter by 3 meter. So you'll fit four mattresses across or two doubles for the mm-hmm. most part. You'll have a little bit of space at the bottoms for your bags. It's canvas. They do a light version, but I would go for a canvas version if you're mm-hmm. wanting something for say Vic High Country.
Yep.
And it packs compact in the sense that it's, you know, I don't know. Do you remember what it is in terms of pack size? Is it like
a Safari or the 300?
No, no, no. The 300 is like
it's still 1.60
centimeters or something.
No, it's longer than that.
Is it?
Yeah. It's not, I wouldn't call it compact. I think to answer your question here, Mark, it comes with a whole bunch of it depends. You can get a four person, like the classic dome I was talking about before is literally something that will fit in the back of a hatch. It's a really compact four person tent that would suit a family. And you could probably find a six person dome. I'm trying to think what's in our range at the moment, but a six person dome.
Like the tough domes you're talking about?
Tough domes, yep. They could be used in a four season rainy, wintry scenario and be much more compact than the Turbo 300. But if you're moving into snow, then there's a whole other consideration with snow shedding. If you're talking heavy snow, the Oztent RV is probably not the best option because of the large flat roof on it. It's going to build up snow. True. The turbos are probably better with the more upright sides in that respect.
The Turbo 300 is 1.4 but 30 centimeters. So like a long sausage.
So they're much bigger. We're talking 4 or 5 times bigger than an equivalent dome tent. excuse me. And on the other end of the scale, if you do want something that performs in really windy, potentially snow type conditions, then an air tent like the Zempire air tents suit just about any condition.
True. Yeah, that do.
The tent might collapse under snow, but it pops back up again. So, but you're moving away from compact when compared to the dome tents I was referring to. So
I think
we need some more context on that question. I think it's quite broad. We can certainly help you. So jump on the Facebook group and with a bit more context if you want, and we can
immediately there's like a million questions that come to mind. Absolutely. Realistically. Yep. But something like just saying something like the Pronto 5, it has a similar shape to your Turbo in the sense that it's got a bit of a tapered roof but then upright walls for space. And that's like, what is that, 280 squared? So you're still going to get four mattresses in and things like that. But yeah, anyway.
The Evo series from Zenpi is another option.
That's true.
There's always some limitations, but you can use three season in a four season scenario. If you need compact, you might need to look at three season and just understand the limitations when you're camping in snow or particularly wet weather.
Yeah.
So a whole bunch of it depends. But if you want more, let us know. Jump on the Facebook group and post another question there.
Okay, so next question is Darren. Now, Darren's obviously posted, well, not obviously for people listening, but obviously for us because he's a prolific group member in terms of Darren. His enthusiasm.
Yep.
Thanks,
love your
Darren.
Input, Darren.
I don't know if it's going to be before this episode goes live or not, but his lad's got an 18th birthday party coming up. So happy birthday to you, lad.
Yep.
Many people go camping in the summer. The summer has been very wet in many places. How to prepare items for storage and what to do if you find mold later on? Should you reseal the material? And then he sort of put an edited to that to know that on episode 12 we did cover some of this, but it might be worth a refresher. True. I think that, yes, wet equals mold, but I think wet plus hot also equals mold, sometimes even worse. I mean, for me personally, straight away, how to prepare your items for storage. Don't store them unless they're bone dry.
Yep. If you're not sure, just leave it hanging out.
Yep.
If it's hot and humid, leave it hanging out even longer. I mean, the people in humid areas of the country are probably going to have better advice than what we've got down here in South Australia, because when it's dry here, it's dry, right? Things dry in half
and
a day.
And it has been super humid this summer for us in South Australia, which is very unusual.
So I guess our version of dry might be different than what you're able to get to in a humid scenario, and particularly canvas materials are susceptible, swags and canvas tents can be susceptible to more mold
and
being impacted by moisture. Sorry.
That's right. No, I should say sorry because I talked over the top of you then. the other thing to consider is sometimes it's not just about it being dry. It's also making sure that it is 100% clean, because even any sort of organic matter in that wet, steamy, humid stuff is going to make mold. Like even if it's just some grass that has some moisture in it and it's in the corner of your tent, that's going to create a little colony of grossness inside your tent. So just really clean, really dry.
And if you can, when you roll it up, the temptation might be to roll it up tightly, but try and roll it as loose as you can in the bag to still allow some airflow or some air gap between the fabrics.
I know it's recommended with like ultralight hiking weight tents and stuff. I mean, ultra lightweight hiking tents and stuff where the material is a lot more susceptible to delamination and stuff because it's so ultralight that it's not recommended to actually pack your tent away rolled up. It's better to store it sort of loosely stuffed in a mesh bag. And I would potentially suggest that if you live somewhere that was quite humid, or you're storing your gear in a space where the sort of temperature or space isn't regulated or controlled, that you might want to consider doing that for your gear, like your tents. Like even if you have like an RV or a Black Wolf or a Coleman or something, maybe just storing your fly in a looser separate bag to your actual tent, things like that.
I guess airflow is the big thing.
Airflow.
Wherever you can, if it's a stagnant, moist garage that you store it in, maybe try and just pull it out where it gets some airflow. Overlying, don't store it wet. As dry as you can.
Yeah. And I think also camp more often, which is super easy to say, but the more you're getting your gear out and using it, the less opportunity there is for things like this to take hold. It's like when we hear about people who are dealing with molds or situations where, you know, their gear's almost ruined, it's usually people who are like, oh, I camped last summer or I camped last winter and I've pulled my tent out 8 months later and it's messed up. Mm. It's like, well, probably is going to be messed up in that case. But in terms of should you reseal the material, it completely depends on the type of material and tent that you've got. I know that if you do get mold on, say, synthetics and nylons, the mold is going to be there. You can kill the spores, but the actual stain and what you can see of the mold, it will stay. There's not really anything that you can do to get rid of that. There are some mold kill treatments that you can use, or clove oil or things like that. I think it's just a matter of patch testing or spot testing on your actual tent fabric to see what the mold treatment is going to do to your material. And I don't think it would hurt, especially if you're doing a larger area, to to even just spray it with some solar proof or like a DWR coating reviver. In terms of canvas, sorry, I'm trying to barrel through the answer of this. In terms of canvas, I'm pretty sure a lot of canvas products these days have that DynaProof treatment or some sort of mold resistant treatment where even if there is mold, it can't actually get inside the fibers of the physical canvas. So warm soapy water can easily wash that off. And I don't think it really does much to the canvas in terms of damaging it because it does have that coating, but it would just be depend on how old your product is and keeping an eye on the performance of it afterwards.
Yep. I was going to say in terms of reproof or resealing, I think it's a common misconception that the products that are used to reseal fabrics, and I use air quotes there, don't replace the PU coating that exists on most fabrics. So most fabrics, canvas included, will have a PU or polyurethane coating, which is applied to the fabric at manufacturing, and better quality fabrics have multiple sort of thin layers on it, a bit like
applied paint,
better to put lots of layers on. If that starts to break down, you can't replace that. The treatments that we use put like a water repellent treatment on the outside to stop the water sort of beading, a bit like waxing your car. But over if your fabric has got to the point where it's deteriorated so much that you're getting plastic flaking off the fabric, you can't fix that.
There is like a gear aid. They do a sealer that you can use for that, but it's more designed for those lighter weight hiking tents where the type of coating and the type of material where is a lot thinner and more flexible. Mm. But in terms of like a heavy duty canvas or family tent, I'm not sure. You could give it a go and I think it would sort of do the trick, but I'm not sure if it's something that's going to be a long-term solution.
Yeah, easiest thing is just to store it dry in the first place.
Yes.
Now, Darren's gone on to ask, what's a weird thing you take camping? SodaStream stable table cross stitch?
Well,
a bit of a cross stitcher, Darren.
Look, I don't think that cross stitch is that weird. I mean, SodaStream and stable table are sort of weird in the sense that they're excessive, but not like, you know, I've joined a couple more different random groups on Facebook and some of the setups that people have, holy heck, I think your head would spin, Benj, like for real. But people legit do, oh, I'm going to the coast and I'm setting up my camp for 2 to 3 weeks with my family and we're camping with other people and we're just going to create this big tent city. And I've literally bought a trailer with an actual fridge, as in a house fridge, and an actual couch, and life is good because this is our home for 3 weeks, you know. And you know, things like that, I'm just like, what the? So for those sort of campers, a SodaStream and a stable table is probably, you know, not a big deal. But for me, I'm like, meh.
But I don't think I really take anything weird. Like my coffee maker is probably the most luxe thing that I take because I could do away with that and just use instant, but I'm not prepared for that.
Yeah.
But I did get a 12-watt projector for the kids for Christmas, and there will be instances for some camping trips where I'll take that because the experience of not to sit there and watch telly all day, but the experience of like let's sit down and watch a movie in the campground in the middle of nowhere.
Is
for a night
fun.
Like the movie is a good experience, right? So that's probably about as weird as I would get.
I take knitting, something you guys may not have known about me, but I'm a knitter. And sometimes I take knitting because, you know, especially in winter when you're sitting around the campfire and you're not relying heaps on lights and it gets dark at 6 and, you know, the kids are in bed and they're reading their books and you're sitting around the campfire. I might be there for a couple of hours, have a glass of wine, do my knitting. Like that's not weird.
I'm keen to know, Darren, are these things on your list of weird things?
Yeah.
Let us know.
But also something that might be considered weird is depending on the type of trip, we might take a battery spit roast.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. It's not weird. Still cooking on the fire, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, next one. I'm going to jump in and do this one too.
Good. Do it.
Shell on Facebook. Perfect fridge capacity for couples planning 1 to 2 week trips. Now, this comes with it depends as well, right?
Like depends who you ask.
Yeah. I would say the most versatile size is 40 to 50 litres.
I was going to say 35 to 45.
Okay. Well, we're in the – let's go 35 to 50.
Yeah. Or let's just make it an even 40.
Well, for a couple, 35 is probably fine depending on how you cook and what you take.
Yeah.
I traveled for 4 months with four of us with a 40-litre Engle.
Yeah.
And managed just fine. It was pretty full at some stages, and there are instances where you kind of need to manage stuff that doesn't need to be refrigerated right now but will need to go back in the fridge at some stage, would sit in different spots of the car. But that suited me just fine. If I had a bigger fridge, would it have been easier? In one respect, yes, because I could have just put more food in the fridge, but it would have also taken up a whole lot more space in my boot, which meant I would have had to redo my entire Tetris setup in the back there.
Yeah.
So I would say around, if it's just two of you, 35 to 45. If there's potential that there's going to be more, then maybe creep up to that sort of 50 litre.
Well, we before we upgraded our fridge, we were running a Waco CFX just before the Dometic CFXs came in, or Dometic just before Dometic came in, 35, which is a 40 litre fridge. And we had that for our family of six, obviously just the two of us and, you know, and our family of six eventually, but we upgraded once the kids sort of, half of them at least, moved into teenagers and their food consumption was a lot higher and we were starting to go away for a lot longer. And it just, I think in that case, it's just a bit easier to just be able to chuck things in the fridge.
Yep.
But a 40 litre was totally doable with some planning and consideration about what we were going to eat and when and how and things like long life milk and long life juice and tins of things. And mostly your food is made up of pantry items or long life items that if they do need refrigerating, it's purely for the period of time until it's consumed, which might only be a day or two. Or if you use, you know, a 500 thing of milk, or you can get smaller things of milk instead of, if you're not going to use 500 mils of milk between the two of you within 2 days or, you know what I'm saying? So there's just lots of ways. And even when you're freezing, if you're choosing to make meals or you're taking meat, how you freeze them in your freezer and make sure they're nice and flat and then they can fit into your fridge. Yeah. And I think it's probably
you can team that up with an ice box as well. I think we did an episode on this quite a while ago. We'll see if we can bring it up
fridges
in the show
versus
notes.
Ice boxes, things that like
that. You can kind of use both.
I think I would potentially go 40, 45 litres, assuming that you are set up for, say, running it as a freezer. And that you can just put things in for a day or two max in the top if you need them refrigerated.
And it also, if you're running it as a fridge, it gives you room for food plus enough beers to get you through the night and then to cool down the next day.
Yeah, definitely. But, yeah, I would sort of say 40, 45 litres should be fine.
I should premise that us using a 45 litre fridge meant that lunch every day for 4 months was basically canned tuna in a wrap. And my daughter to this day, 2 years later, still cringes every time I mention the T word.
We did tuna. Eat tuna every day for lunch for like 4 months. But I think it's just, just 40, 45 litres, eat like you're camping. Don't eat like you would necessarily expect to eat at home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you consider other things about how it fits into your camp setup, vehicle, et cetera as well.
Yeah.
You can do the next one.
Arit on Facebook, family of five camping without a caravan, moving every couple of days max, recommended setups, a tent or a rooftop, a van deck out, gazebo or awnings, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So
depends on what
family of five camping without a caravan,
there's a whole bunch
moving
of questions.
Every couple of days max. So I'm assuming we're talking about.
Are you towing?
Yeah.
Do you have a trailer? There's a lot of questions that go with that.
Yeah. I'm assuming that we're talking about, you know, if someone's talking about moving every couple of days max, I'm assuming it's because they're planning to go away for an extended period of time.
A long
couple of months.
Extended trip. Yeah.
Extended trip.
So it's probably a larger vehicle then, four wheel drive or something with a bit of capacity. We make some assumptions here.
We are making some assumptions. I mean, potentially if you're somebody who is like, hey, I have a family of five and I drive a Toyota Corolla, but this is what I want to do with my life for 2025 and I'm trying to work out, you know, how to start planning
Arit's asked, like, said, is a van deck out potential? So maybe you're in, maybe Arit's in the stages of like, I want to do this. What do I even do?
So for me, I'm going to say van deck out for sure, only because that's what I've done and we've done as a family of six, and it's freaking awesome.
But you add a few tents to that as well for sleeping arrangements. Yeah, it works.
So it's like the van deck out primarily means that everything you need is set up like a rolling camp trailer that you don't need to set up. The only things that we have that do need to be set up are the two tents for the kids, which are the swaggers, which are literally up in 2 minutes, mm-hmm. 3 minutes max. And we've got a couple of mattresses that just go in there and they're sleeping bags and that's it. We've got a pull-out kitchen, all of our drawer systems, all of our storage is in there, our bed's in there. We've got a huge big awning. We've got a couple of awning walls now that we can add to that. It's really straightforward. Even if we want to say if we're going, you know, you've mentioned moving every couple of days max. So hypothetically, we're somewhere for 4 or 5 days. We want to do some side trips. You just pull your awning in and drive away. It's not like you have you know, like I was going to suggest maybe a rooftop tent if you're not, but it would need to be a large one, like a 1600 one, for example, if you want all your family up there. But if you're not driving, but I would only recommend that if you're not planning on also doing side trips, which I think in your experience, being able to do side trips is really important.
Well, yeah. So yeah, I think, at a very basic level, a van kit out would be the easiest in terms of set up and pack down every night, yeah, because you've got your kitchen and stuff almost as good as set up before you've even, yeah, brought up to camp, and a few very easy to set up shelters for the kids. Mm-hmm. That makes set up and pack down really easy. You can be on and off the road pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But that comes with limitations, right? And that's if it's a van, you've got some forward drive limitations, some places that you can't, mm-hmm, go. So if you do plan on doing a lot of forward driving, long sort of unsealed roads, then you probably, yep, need a four-wheel drive, and the van setup becomes a bit of an issue. Then you need to think about other shelter options.
I'm just going to interrupt here only because we, with our Sprinter, we've got four-wheel drive tires on our Sprinter, and we've disabled the Euro cars have this weird like traction control thing, disabled that. Mm-hmm. And we lower our PSI, and there's very few places that we haven't,
yep,
been able to go that we wanted to. So pretty much everywhere we've wanted to go, we've been able to do that.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think it's worth investing in a four-wheel drive van for the additional costs of that, unless you're wanting to do some really hardcore four-wheel driving. But also another reason why I wanted to preface that is because someone who works at our Adelaide store, Michael, he has a Hyundai iLoad, and I have seen videos of him taking that bad boy through some crazy tracks in a convoy with all of his mates who are in four-wheel drives, and he just sends it in his bloody iLoad and, yep, no issues whatsoever. So I mean,
you're right. There's limitations, but there's also ways around those limitations. Yeah. You just need to understand what those limitations are. You're going to get to a point where a two-wheel drive van can't go where a four-wheel drive can go, but,
yeah,
you just need to be realistic about what you want to do. If you are literally just doing a lap of Australia and you're not hitting all the crazy tracks, a van's going to be more than fine. You could do, yeah, a lot of the dirt, main dirt roads in your data track and a lot of those open sort of roads quite easily. If you're talking water crossings and big sand dunes and that sort of thing, probably going to have some limitations there.
Yeah.
So you'll need a four-wheel drive in that, yeah, respect.
Yeah, like you can't do the Simpson Desert.
No.
In a Sprinter van.
If you're doing moving every couple of days in a four-wheel drive, a tent's going to get tedious putting it up and down. I did it with a tent, but we had times where we were somewhere for 3 nights, 4 nights, for a week. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't doing it all the time.
Yeah.
If you do go for a tent, get an easy to set up tent. So Austin RV, Turbo Black Wolf, or an air tent.
Yeah.
Otherwise, rooftop tent. Rooftop tent's going to have to come with a vehicle that can carry it. So four-wheel drive with a rooftop tent on top.
And especially if you're looking at like a 1600 or 1800, it's, yeah, going to be a lot heavier and bigger.
You're not going to fit a family of five in a 16 or even a 2200. Mm. You're going to squeeze a family of five in. So it depends how old your kids are. If they're old, yep, enough, then get like the swaggers or something simple so that you can roll the rooftop tent out, maybe a pull-out kitchen. yeah. in the back of your four-wheel drive and a couple of shelters, smaller shelters for the kids to sleep in.
And in terms of gazebos or awnings, I think it's just awnings every time, only because when you consider the type of gazebos and sort of what's out there in terms of functional space, it's just, especially if you choose to go with something like a tent, it's just another thing that you have to pull out and set up and then pack away and put in a bag and whatever. Whereas there's just, even though you still obviously have to set up and pack away and zip it up with awnings, there's just that level of ease and simplicity there that gives them the advantage over over a gazebo or something like that. I mean,
so it comes with a bunch, the same as the last question, Mark's question about the compact four-season tent for family of four. This comes with a whole lot of kind of depends. So it depends on how old your kids are, but if you want more, jump in the Facebook group and ask some more questions, because I think there's definitely more than one way to do it.
Definitely.
There's going to be shortcomings no matter which way you choose. You just need to choose which of those paths best suits what you want to get out of your trip.
Correct. The only thing I would sort of tack on to the end of that is something like a kitting out your van or doing your own van build. It's actually quite cheap. Like if you're going to get someone else to do it, or you want to be like super fancy, like van life influencers or whatever, might be a bit more expensive. But realistically, if you are handy in any way, shape or form and have a good collection of tools, it's so easy and so cheap to set it up yourself.
If you're not worried about Instagram worthy van setup shots and just want to enjoy the experience, then do it yourself. Next is Robert from Facebook again. Best portable lithium battery packs for 70-litre fridge/freezer.
Okay, so, right, depends. depends if you are also, you have a solar blanket and solar systems, that whether or not you're topping up your battery or if you're just expecting one battery pack to cover you for your trip. If you are, how long are you going away for? I personally don't think there's such a thing as the best.
No.
But there is such a thing as the best for you. Mm. And what is the best for you is going to be different to what is the best for somebody else. So one thing that I often find when talking to people about getting portable power packs and things like that is that cost can be a bit of a limitation initially, especially if you're also thinking about adding in solar panels and stuff. You know, you could be looking anywhere between $1,500 to $2,000 for a 200, 300 watt solar panel and a 100 amp plus lithium battery. So for a lot of people, that's not quite achievable. So something like the Hardcore battery box is something that I always think is a really great option, because you can put a cheaper AGM battery in there and then have the ability to remove the battery and then put a lithium battery in it in the future when you're ready to upgrade. Or those power stations that are becoming really popular because they're just so convenient. They're sort of like a set and forget. They have their built-in BMS, like it's just for people.
You've got all USB ports.
USB ports. Some of them even have 240 volt output and a little mini inverter. Like there's so much about those that are convenient, and they sort of just work for people who don't necessarily want to get into that whole 12 volt system setup thing. The limitations for those, in my personal opinion, is that you could be paying $1,800 for something that in 5 years' time might finish its life cycles, depending on how often you're camping and how often you're using it, that will then just need to be replaced.
Yep.
So for me, thinking long term, I find things like a Hardcore battery box, for example, really appealing, because you can continuously upgrade your battery throughout the lifetime of the battery box if you want to.
Yep.
And it does also have things like little USB outputs and what have you.
Yeah.
But I think whether or not you have a 70-litre fridge or a 30-litre fridge, the load that that's going to be putting on your system depends on how often you're using it, how often you're opening it, what it's full of, if you're pre-cooling it. There's a whole range of different things there. But I would say roughly working off – maybe a continuous average load of about 3 amp hours for a 70-litre.
Two and a half to three,
Yeah, because I think I've got
about three.
Yeah, I think I've – like we've got an 80-litre and I'm pretty sure that it goes anywhere between two and three.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you're not using solar, 3 amp hour, I mean, on average, there might be times, especially overnight, where the duty cycle comes on, doesn't need to do anything because it's holding its temperature. And so you might have hours overnight where it's not really drawing anything at all. But, you know, what's that like 60, roughly 60 amp hours a day in a 24-hour period if you're working off 3 hours? You know, 2 days, that's 120, 3 days, that's 150 amp hours. So I would just say, like, a rule of thumb, 100 amp hour battery.
I think, yeah.
With a 200, 250 watt solar blanket.
Yep. I was.
You'd be laughing.
I was saying if you just had to get a power pack to cover most scenarios, I was waiting to see where you went with that. I would have said about 100. You can get like, Companion do that little 40 amp. The
Rover.
Rover 40, which seems to be quite a reliable little unit. Mm. That will suit as well. If you're driving, running your fridge off your car while you're driving and then you're taking it out at night and you need power for overnight, that will get you by for overnight and then you plug them both back into your car while you drive the next day. So it depends on how you use it.
Yeah.
And you don't have to spend heaps of money that way. But if you are going to stop somewhere, run it for a day, you need to top the battery up and then run it for another day and you're not driving in between or you're leaving it separate from your car, then you're probably going to need 100 amp hours with that 200-ish watt panel, which is going to give you probably over and – it should give you over and above what the fridge requires, which means you're powering your fridge and charging the battery off solar during the day on a good sunny day.
Yep.
So you've then got enough power to get through the night.
And I think that, you know, sometimes I hear reviews from people who've taken their 40-litre fridge away and they've got a Rover 40, which is 40 amp hours, which is I think only works out to like 32 actual usable amp hours when you factor in that 80%. And that 32 amp hours has run their fridge for a whole weekend trip away. So, you know, but that's because of how they're using their fridge and the load has been a lot lower. So, you know, I think it's better for you to err on the side of caution and make sure that you have a battery that's definitely going to cover you than picking a smaller capacity battery that you're pretty sure will cover you, but you know, you have no leeway and then you fall short.
Yeah. Lots of it depends. Once again, Robert, as we said with a bunch of other questions, if you need more clarity, then jump on the Facebook group. And if we can't answer it, I'm sure a bunch of other people who've experienced it and have got their way of operating will have some awesome suggestions.
Yes.
Last question.
Last
I don't know
question.
How long, we haven't got a little timer up here today, so I don't know how long we've been talking, but it feels like it's been quite a while.
Okay.
So I think we're over an hour, so.
This is our last question for the episode as well.
So hang in there.
So hang in there. And I think we're sort of ending on a high, maybe.
I don't know. It's a bit of
Scott from
here,
Facebook. What's the best way that someone has managed a quiet bush camping situation where another camper has arrived and proceeded to run a petrol generator for hours and hours? I understand why some people might need to quickly recharge batteries, et cetera, but it's just a struggle when it's running for 8 hours plus.
Eight plus hours for a generator a campsite is just not on.
It's not on. And no. When I was initially reading through this, it did sort of make my blood boil a little bit that people would be that not inconsiderate necessarily, but just blatantly unaware.
I'm okay for running it from, I mean, I do that with the car. If I'm not running, not doing anything for a while, I pick a day during the day and turn the car on and run it to get some charge back in the battery just to keep me going. That's noisy, but I do it during the day, but I don't run it for 8 hours.
I mean, there's a saying and I don't know what it is and you might know what it is. And I'm probably going to make a fool of myself here, which obviously everybody knows I don't mind doing. Isn't it something like you catch more flies with honey, or there's some sort of saying about how you can be more successful dealing with a shitty situation if you approach it in a positive way.
Yeah.
I don't know what the saying is. Someone please let me know. But
I know what you mean.
I would personally, and quite thankfully, I've not been in this situation because I'm sure the reality of how I would deal with it is going to be very.
I wouldn't want to be in the receiving end of that.
Very different to what my advice is going to be, but I think that potentially having a chat with the person, introducing yourself, getting to know them a little bit, understanding why they're using their generator, what the purpose is, expressing a little bit about your intentions for your camp and whether or not there's a way that you guys can come to an agreement in that sense, is probably the most positive way or the way that you're going to get the best outcome that you can without ruining your trip, in the sense that not saying anything or not doing anything about it, you will just sit there getting angrier and angrier and you're going to be way more upset about it and your trip's going to be ruined and they're probably quite happily using all of their 240 volt devices. They don't care.
Yep.
Or two, you could approach it with frustration and anger and end up in a situation where, you know, who knows what's going to happen. Like
I'm with you there. I think just a starting point's a polite conversation around where if you're in a situation where it's not a powered site, there's not other generators around, there's not a heap of noise around, it is actually a quiet remote bush campsite and someone's using a generator, I think you're well within your rights to go and have the conversation and question for how they use it, but with an understanding of like, okay, so you do need it. Is there a time that I can expect you're going to use it so I can work around what you need and we can all be harmonious
and
in the campsite?
And I think definitely approaching that conversation with, you know, actually intending to or being open with empathy to understand why they need to use it and have some understanding for them is a lot better than if you're going over there and you're asking the questions but you're remaining sort of closed off to them, because that will still come across in a negative way. And I think that realistically, as time goes on, generators are just becoming less and less popular. Majority of people I talk to are like, generators are rubbish, bro. Like the opinions around generators are really changing, and that's also reflected in national parks and campgrounds and stuff also banning generators. So depending on where you are actually camping, it might also be a situation where if things aren't going well, if it is within a national park or a conservation park or something, there might actually be a phone number for the on-shift ranger that you can contact.
Particularly if there are, if it is a banned product in that site.
Or, you know, somebody like a site manager or somebody that you can get in touch with who can come and assist you with the situation. But, you know, the reality is if you pulled up to someone and they're using it and they're just obnoxious and they're just being a tool and there's just no way that you can find a common ground, in my experience, those sorts of people aren't going to change.
You're either going to have to put up with it. Make the most of it or just move.
Or move.
It's just not cool camping etiquette.
It's not.
But you can't change some people.
No.
Anyway, I think we've been talking for ages. That's a bonzer of an episode to open up with for season 4, episode 1. Any further questions, both for the people who have asked these questions and we didn't really give them a very good answer, please elaborate more in the Facebook group. And if anyone's got any other questions based on this, also just jump in the Facebook group. Or in the, we'll use the YouTube,
or YouTube
community in there as well. So ask some questions in there too.
Yep, we'll be back next fortnight with session 2.
It's 2 and 3, after... Number three's after that. Don't need to ask for another Q&A.
For a while.
Bunch of questions for a while. We've got heaps here. So
yeah.
Thanks for tuning in. As we mentioned, don't forget to subscribe here or your podcast app. Thanks for tuning in and we'll see you next fortnight.
Catch you later.
Bye.